morning and welcome to our new series, a three-part series on Israel's chief rabbis. It's good to see everybody back. I see one or two new faces also, which is wonderful. I never know what to do in terms of the estimate of how many people are going to be here when I give the office the room set up. So we had about 25 or so registered, and I said, okay, so I assume that means we'll have about 35 or so. We're a little bit above, I think. So this layout, I don't know. Still comfortable? Still roughly okay? Certainly everyone sitting at the tables is fine. You know? It's everybody else. I don't know. All right. Maybe. Yeah. I don't like it when they make it such a large rectangle. That's the thing. All right. Either way, we'll figure it out. Thank you to Betty for again helping with the people signing in the beginning. If anybody still needs to register, if anybody is not on the email list for the class especially, please see me afterwards. This is indeed designed as a three-week class. It's an encore of sorts in the sense that in our June series, the June-July series, we talked about four of Israel's chief rabbis. Rabbi Ziering and I gave a four-part series at that point. That was the class that was at Or Chaim, and people wanted to talk about more chief rabbis. They liked the topic. So I said, all right, well, we'll revisit with a three-week now. We have quite the lineup. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef is our opener. We'll talk about him in a moment. Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu is going to be the second one. He was the successor of Rabbi Yosef. And then followed by Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cook, who wasn't actually a chief rabbi of the state of Israel because he's pre-state. But he is the first one in the British mandate, and certainly somebody, when you talk about chief rabbis, you have to talk about him. The truth is that Rabbi Ovadia Yosef is going to need more than 1 week. So what I'm going to try to do, because Rav Cook definitely needs a whole week to himself, so Rabbi Eliyahu is going to pay the price. He's going to get crunched next week. That's really what's going to have to happen. When we talked about chief rabbis back in June, we established that a chief rabbi's role is with communities and individuals, both, in Israel as well as internationally, representing Judaism, determining halachic policy, somebody who needs to have sensitivity to all Jews. It's a job which is both clergy and politician. And so we looked at the chief rabbis at that point and asked, how do they blend those two roles? So today, we're going to look at someone who may well be the most famous chief rabbi, and whose impact was certainly among the greatest. And that is Maran HaChacham Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. Actually, before I launch into that, just if you have a cell phone and it happens not to be on silent and you could silence it, better to ask now than after it rings. Okay. What do you know about Rabbi Ovadia Yosef? What can you tell me? Sephardi, that was one. Good. Sorry? I'm not sure I'd use the word nice. No, I don't say that in a pejorative way, but I'm not sure I would use the word nice. And you'll see what I mean. What comes to mind to me for nice doesn't really come to mind for me with him. Powerful, okay. Very big hat, this is true. Turban, in point of fact. Not hat, but turban. Yes. Yes. Definitely somebody with a regal character to him, the way he carried himself. Part of that is the regalia, just the outfit that went with the position. But part of it is definitely the way he carried himself. And in fact, that was part of his mission. One phrase that you're going to hear from me repeatedly in Hebrew is Lachazir Atara LeYoshna, which means to return the crown, or to restore the crown to days of old. And that has multiple meanings for him, as we're going to talk about. But just the idea, the reference to a crown already tells you something about what it is that he's trying to accomplish. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef was really an outsized figure. He was born in 1920, passed away in 2013. So he had quite a long and very, very accomplished life. Before we launch into biography and we talk about his mission and what he did and how he was perceived, I want to give you, by way of introduction, a few paragraphs that I think will demonstrate that not only did he have a major impact, but he had a conflicted impact. People saw him very differently, depending on where they were. Take a look at the first source, please. This is from Professor Yehuda Mirsky, an article entitled Rav Ovadia, written in honor of his 90th birthday. One of the more outsized personalities in Israel's history is Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, the longtime head of the Shas political party, not just head of, but founder of the Shas political party. If you wanted to guess, how many chief rabbis have founded political parties? Right. The answer is one. That's him. He's the only one to do it. He did it after he was done being chief rabbi. We'll talk about that. But he is the longtime head of the Shas political party who has just marked his 90th birthday. Rav Ovadia, as he is known, rose from a poor and undistinguished family to the summit of rabbinic and then political leadership through the sheer force of his learning and personality and the coincidence of his passions with some of the deepest currents in Israeli society. And that's really like never a truer sentence was written about Rav Ovadia. He didn't come into this with wealth. He didn't come into this with connections. What he had was incredible scholarship. And when I say incredible, we'll talk a little bit more about that, but there's nobody like him. This was, to say a generational talent is an understatement in terms of what he could do, just intellectually. And that combined with the fact that, as he puts it here, his passions, that which drove him, also drove a major sector of Israeli society that until he came along had been out of power in Israel despite their numbers, and he tapped into that and he channeled that. And between the respect that people had for his intellect and the fact that what he was promoting resonated with them, that was what brought him to power. It wasn't about who he knew. It wasn't about who his ancestors were. His father was a shopkeeper. There's nothing there. And yet he became really one of the most influential figures in Israeli history. Continuing the paragraph here, the foreign public knows of him vaguely as a right-wing fanatic, more on that shortly, but the truth and perhaps the tragedy of the man are far more complicated and fascinating. His ability to merge the intellectual elitism of the yeshiva with a common touch was to become one leitmotif of his career. Another was his pride, together with his boiling resentment of those who ignored or dismissed his accomplishments. Foremost among the latter were the members of the Ashkenazi establishment, religious and secular alike. They would come to regret it. We'll talk about that. Rising through the ranks, Rav Ovadia served as a rabbinic judge in Cairo, Petah Tikva, and Jerusalem, and as chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, teaching all the while. In dozens of immensely learned books and countless rulings, he staked out a distinctive judicial philosophy with two components. The first was encapsulated by the slogan I've already mentioned to you, to restore the crown to its former glory, L'Hachzir Atara LeYoshna. The crown was the tradition of Sephardi Halakha that had come to full fruition in Yosef Karo, the 16th century author of the still authoritative law code Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. This tradition, in Rav Ovadia's view, had been contaminated, if not downright smothered, by centuries of Ashkenazi stringencies, dialectics, and arrogance. The second component of his legal philosophy was his leavening of unshakable traditionalism with a humane responsiveness to changing times and circumstances. And you'll see how he manages both sides of what seems to be a contradiction. He actually does serve both. Authoritative, audacious, and decisive, Rav Ovadia eventually got the better of his rivals. In 1972, he unseated his longtime nemesis, Yitzchak Nissim, to become the Rishon LeZion, the Sephardi chief rabbi, and then his real troubles began. It happens to be a very good essay. I gave you the link there, which, you know, if you have the version I sent in the email, it's clickable. When I send out the follow-up email later today, so you'll have the handout that way, you can see it. It's worth reading the full article. But that's one side. What would you describe as the tenor of Dr. Mirsky's article towards Rav Ovadia? How does he feel about Rav Ovadia?
Envious.
I would say admiring more than envious. And when you maybe I'm biased by reading the full article. I don't think he would want to trade places necessarily. Certainly admiring. Right. Well, I'm asking his perspective.
Rabbi Mirsky, I think, respects that this man has had a humble beginning as a chief
Right. Right. I think there's a lot of respect here. Take a look at the next one. This is from Yossi Sarid. Now, those of you who know Yossi Sarid are aware that you're going to get a different perspective. Yossi Sarid, a leader of the Peace Now movement, and really, I don't like the term anti-religious. I wouldn't apply it to just anybody. But yeah, I think it fits. I mean that not in a humorous way. He was truly angered by the religious establishment in Israel, and whenever a statement would be issued by Rabbi Yosef or by anyone whose first name was Rabbi, you could rely on him to have something to say against it. So keep that in mind as you read what he says here. The article is titled, If He's the Greatest, We're in Trouble. And it's about Rabbi Ovadia. You see the date, October of 2013. This was the last week or two of Rabbi Ovadia's life. Rabbi Ovadia passed away mid-October 2013. After his death, may he reach the ripe old age of 120 before that happens, it will be hard to call him a saint. In life, we didn't see him as a saint. And so we have no reason to call him one as he lies on his deathbed. We are not abandoning a sick old man because he was never ours to begin with. When our enemy falls or becomes deathly ill, we must not rejoice, but at the same time, we cannot forgive. This is the, quote, spiritual leader whose spirit was bad, who viciously attacked all those who disobeyed, all those who did not bleed shas. Now, as his family and entourage quarrel over succession, we should recall all those he cursed. Gentiles and Arabs, black people and women, teachers and gays, reformed Jews, secular Jews, and even religious Jews who didn't follow his teachings. Let us not forget the cursed politicians and disparaged judges and the Israeli soldiers who were lookouts during Shabbat but did not observe the holy day and thus died of their own fault. Now, he is doing what Rav Ovadia knew was going on in the last, I'd say, 20 years of his life, which is pulling certain passages from what Rabbi Ovadia said publicly and asking him, what do you mean by that? Except he's not asking him at this point. He's putting it in an article for the world to read. It's not a discussion. It's more of, look what he said today or look what he said last night. I'm familiar with some of the passages that he is mentioning here, and the ones I am familiar with, if you look in context, they become very different statements. But this is also part of the legacy of Rav Ovadia, which he knew about. He was very aware that the things he said were being viewed and quoted in this way, and he still felt justified in expressing what he expressed and choosing the format in which he expressed it, for reasons we're going to get to. But Rav Ovadia is aware that this is part of his legacy as well, even as he's doing it. So keep this in mind on the flip side of his legacy. Yes. Yeah, I think so.
He was aware that he was,
and he was 100% aware. Yes. We'll talk more about that as well. A third piece. This is from an outsider. You've heard from Yehuda Mirsky. You've heard from Yossi Sarid. Now you get The Guardian, the obituary for Rabbi Ovadia Yosef from The Guardian in England, which both praises and condemns his politics. Take a look. Resplendent in his gold brocaded black gowns and purple turbans, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who has died age 93, often resembled a medieval stranger marooned in the modern world. In fact, he was one of Israel's most astute public operators. As spiritual head of the ultra-Orthodox Shas party, Yosef influenced the course of Israeli politics. And as former chief rabbi to Israel's Sfaradim and Mizrahim, we'll talk about Sfaradi and Mizrahi a little bit later, Jews of Iberian, North African, and Middle Eastern origin, he rekindled a sense of communal pride not experienced for centuries. But it was as spiritual mentor of Shas, an acronym for Sfaradi Torah Guardians, that he truly made his mark. Shas, again, is the party that he founded. Shas to most observant Jews is an acronym for Shishas Nedarim. It means the Talmud. But here, in context as the party of the Sfaradim, Sfaradi Torah Guardians, that he truly made his mark. The party began as a municipalist in Jerusalem in 1983. Then Yosef dictated its policies and handpicked its prospective Knesset members, including the 25-year-old Aryeh Deri, a rabbi and friend of his son David. Soon, Shas blossomed into a national political force that fused religious zeal with an ability to articulate Sephardi grievances. For despite constituting half the population, Sephardim still felt that both Israel's secular establishment and Ashkenazi-run Orthodox parties treated them like second-class citizens. You start to get a more full picture of where his appeal was within society and where his impact was. So, last piece I want to show you here is source number 4 from the Times of Israel in describing his funeral. And I brought you first a paragraph that just describes the funeral, and then after that what they quote from Shimon Peres at the funeral. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, the powerful, much loved, and sometimes controversial spiritual leader of Israel's Sephardi community, passed away in Jerusalem early Monday afternoon after being hospitalized repeatedly over the last several weeks. He was 93. Ovadia was laid to rest Monday night in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Sanhedria, with some 800,000 mourners converging from all over the country to attend what became the largest funeral in Israeli history. The 800,000 number is the high number you hear quoted. Those who didn't like him will say something like 500,000, as though that somehow diminishes. When you think about it, this is in 2013, you had roughly 6 million Jews in Israel. So if it's 800,000, you realize that means like more than 1 in 10 of every Jew in the land is there at the funeral. Far beyond the numbers police had anticipated, but there were no reports of serious injuries. There was actually a baby born at the funeral. Here's the quote now from Shimon Peres. A few hours ago, I went to the hospital to say goodbye to my teacher, my rabbi, my friend, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. President Shimon Peres relates in an official statement. It was a difficult time. Tears filled my eyes. My throat was choked with emotion. I held his hand, which was still warm, and kissed his forehead. When I pressed his hand, I felt I was touching history. And when I kissed his head, it was as though I kissed the very greatness of Israel, he added. Immediately after the fall of the Second Temple, there were two greats of the Torah, Yochanan ben Zakkai and Yehuda Hanasi, Peres continues, adding, I mention them because they came to the conclusion that for the Jewish people to survive, we need to study. Rabbi Yosef symbolized that and acted upon it. He was simply a great man. His greatness wasn't measured, but rather it was felt as a spiritual wind in every corner, lighting up the darkness in unexpected places. When I met him, I sensed he was a great man with an unbelievable memory and the wisdom to share his knowledge with others. His contribution was his love for Israel, and he solved problems no one else could solve, using his wisdom and spirituality. Peres, who had known Yosef for decades, was among the last to visit the rabbi's hospital bed earlier in the day before his passing. Wow. So when you say, when I ask people, what do you think of him? And someone says, nice. You understand why I
said that because I met him.
You met him. So he was nice to meet in person. That's actually really important.
All children at school.
Yeah.
That's why they're very, very emotional, very, very caring.
Right. So that's a very important point, which is he had the gift that you will find among the most successful politicians. Which is, when you meet him in person, he's a human being, and an emotional one, and one who connects with people. And even though, as you're going to see, he had a mind like no other, an intellect like no other, and he led this massive political movement, he loved people, and connected with them in that way. As you're going to see, we're going to talk about this. Yeah? Right. So we're going to come back to that. But in one example, there were about 1,000 women after the Yom Kippur War who were agunot. Their husbands were missing in action. And he wrote responsa for each one that permitted them to be able to get married. He found justification in each case to say that the husband was in fact dead. 1,000. Not one or five or ten. So that's an example. That's an example of what Shimon Peres is referring to. So what I want to understand here, as we look at this, is he a rabbi? Is he a politician? What do we make of this chief rabbi? You know, we talked about Rabbi Unterman, and he was clearly a chief rabbi with sensitivity to the community. For those who were there, you'll remember what we discussed about Rabbi Unterman. That was fairly clear. We talked about Rabbi Avram Shapira, and he was somebody who was a rabbi without any patience for politics. He guarded the nation in the sense that he told his followers at the time of the disengagement, they shouldn't participate. If they're in the IDF, they should disobey orders, but don't do anything violent to anybody else. That was his red line. But he was very clearly rabbi and with no interest in politics. But here you have a chief rabbi who founds a political party and leads it for nearly 30 years, and whose influence is based on the appeal he had, in particular, as was noted in one of the pieces, to those who felt they were second-class citizens. Sephardi and Mizrahi, as we're going to see. So there is so much material for this. I mean, Rav Ovadia, because of when he lived, and because he was so prolific, there's just so much to say about him. I'm going to do my best here. Again, I said, he's going to go over the hour. He's going to go into next week also. But you have to know, I'm necessarily condensing a lot. So we'll talk about that as well, because he was... That you're talking about during his chief rabbinate, or you're talking about... So he starts out during the time of Golda Meir. He starts out with Golda Meir. He continues through Begin. That's his era. In politics, his party was allied with, at times, Netanyahu, and at times Rabin. He went to both ends of the political spectrum, as you'll see. So, a brief history of Ashkenazim and Sephardim in modern Israel, and here I'm going to have to monologue somewhat just in order to get basic information. Go back to when the land that is today the state of Israel is part of the Ottoman Empire. So, you're talking about a period that lasts, obviously, for centuries. The Ottoman Empire, the Jewish community of the Ottoman Empire, was basically Mizrahi or Sephardic. Now, I'm going to do an injustice here to centuries and centuries of Jewish culture by blending Mizrahi and Sephardic. They're not the same population. Theoretically, Mizrahi is Jews of Middle Eastern heritage, whereas Sephardic should be, what's Sfarad? Spain. The problem is that it spreads, that culture spreads from Spain into North Africa, areas like Morocco, right, across the Mediterranean. It spreads to Egypt. It spreads to Iraq. Like, it becomes very difficult for me, poor Ashkenazi boy, to understand where the lines are drawn, and more to the point, when you get to this period of our history, meaning the last 30 years, it really does get blended in ways that make it difficult to unsort it. So I'm going to generally blend it together, understanding that really we're doing it something of an injustice here. Largely the Jews in the Ottoman Empire were Mizrahi or Sephardic, except for some Ashkenazim who arrived with the expulsions from the Iberian Peninsula at the end of the 15th century. Right, when we're kicked out of Spain, Portugal, Italy, and so on, there are Ashkenazim there as well who arrive. But basically, the population there, including in Israel, is a Sephardi population. Ashkenazim only start to arrive in any real numbers in Israel at the end of the 18th century. Students of the Vilna Gaon from Lithuania and some of the Hasidim from Poland show up in Israel at that point. Greater numbers in the middle of the 19th century, but the bulk of the population really is Sephardic at that stage. There are various splits between the communities, right? You have those who have been there for generations and those who were new. You had those who had one set of practices and those who had another. Most important, as always, is you have financial divisions between the two. Going all the way back to the time of the Talmud 2,000 years ago, Jews would collect funds in their communities and send it to Jewish communities in Israel to support them. There's a lot of discussion in Jewish law over the centuries of what should be my priorities in my charitable spending. What if there are Jews in need in Israel and there are Jews in need locally? Is there any sense of prioritizing support for a Jewish community in the land of Israel? So that's a very old concept, and it's something that becomes known in later centuries as the chalukah. My Hebrew speakers, what's a chalukah? Sorry? Division? Distribution. Right, distribution. L'chalek. I mean, they're from the same root. They so it's a distribution, and at the time originally they that it starts, and as it's run through the centuries, it's basically under the Sephardim. It's run by the Sephardic communities. They're the dominant population in the land. But starting in the late 18th century, some of the Ashkenazi communities create their own system of collection and distribution. They say, we're not getting a proper share from the Sephardim, so we are going to do our own. And those groups grow. They become more powerful. They splinter into sub-Ashkenazi groups. When we talk about Rav Kook, we're going to talk about the split between some of the Ashkenazi groups in terms of these funds as well. But each ethnic group manages its own funds. Then you get to the new Zionists of the early 20th century. Because those who came in with the Bilu movement starting in the 1870s, 1880s, those who were funded by Baron Rothschild, those groups tended to be Ashkenazi. And the early government, the Jewish agency, that group tends to be Ashkenazi. And so what happens is the Sephardim, who have been living there for a very long time, are suddenly subordinate to the Ashkenazim who are in authority. Take a look, please, on your sheet. It's source number 5. For those who came in later, I think there may be some sheets still by the hot water. This is from a fellow named Kevin Lim. From Plowshares to Swords, the Sephardi Ashkenazi Schism and the Problems of Ethnic Discourse in Israel. Despite the Yishuv's Sephardi tenor, Yishuv is the old settlement, those who had lived there before the new age of immigration. The early Zionists who engineered the founding of Medinat Yisrael, the state of Israel, were predominantly Ashkenazim. Having conceived of the labor movement among other Zionist strains, the Russian and Polish Jews of the second and third Aliyot in particular developed a pioneer ethos reflecting their socialist values. If the prospect of the biblical ingathering attracted the more traditional Sephardim, the raw secularism of Ashkenazim alienated them. As Dowdy, Ben Raphael, and Sharot observe, the, quote, new Jew and the anti-diasporism postulated by Ashkenazim contradicted the Sephardi ideal of Zionism as a reinforcement of traditional Jewishness rather than a revolution against it. In other words, the Sephardim tend to be more observant. They tend to be more religious in their practice. The Ashkenazim who are coming in tend to be there more for the sake of creating a new ideal, a socialist society that was still anchored potentially in Jewish values for many of them, and still anchored even in Jewish text for many of them. You think of a Ben-Gurion with his love of Tanakh, but they're not looking for religious observance in this new state of Israel. With greater education and resources, the European-born pioneers were able to establish a network of institutions that by 1948 had coalesced into a full-fledged infrastructure and, quote, the basic point of reference. Everything is surrounding them. Everything revolves around them. For all its rhetoric, the Zionist elite failed to implement an inclusive model for the integration of exiles, Mizug Galuyot, forcing the, quote, backward and primitive Sephardim into Eurocentric Procrustean bed instead. The Procrustean bed, for those who don't remember the term, right, is an old Greek idea also found in Midrashim regarding Sodom about Procrustes, how he has his bed and visitors are welcome to come sleep in the bed, but if they're too long for the bed, then cut them off. If they're too short for the bed, then you stretch them. So that's what you're doing to the Sephardim. You're saying, if you don't fit into this new model, the socialist, less observant type of an approach to Jewish life in the land of Israel, you're going to have to be made to fit. And that is something which is successful to a certain extent in its impact on the Sephardi population. Source number 6. I'm giving you a lot of text because there's so much that you need to know in order to recognize what it was that Rabbi Ovadia Yosef was coming into, the world in which he operated and what created it. So number 6, the roots of anti-Mizrahi racism in Israel. Israel's media was abuzz Monday following the release of an overtly racist commercial targeting Mizrahi Jews. You're not going to believe this. Unless you saw it online, the video is available, you're not going to believe it. The commercial for the upscale housing development of Karmei Gat, planned to be built in the middle of Kiryat Gat, a working class town largely populated by Mizrahim, Jews from Arab and or Muslim countries, features a religious Ashkenazi family, Jews of Eastern European origin, lighting Hanukkah candles together. All of a sudden they are disrupted by two neighbors unabashedly portrayed as Mizrahi who barge in to ruin Hanukkah with their vulgarity and ignorance of authentic Jewish practice. The message, by moving to Carmel Gat, you can live among other real white Jews without having to worry about those pesky, benighted brown people. The video, produced by Be'emunah, a real estate company that specializes in building, quote, quality housing for the religious public, was widely panned in the media and was taken down almost as quickly as it went up. But the bitter taste couldn't be wiped out, especially since the video was released on the very same day that official Israel commemorates the expulsion of Jews from Arab and Muslim lands. Those who may be shocked by the blatant bigotry in the Carmel Gat video must remember that racist attitudes towards Mizrahim are part and parcel of Israel's DNA. The founders of the state, Jews of Ashkenazi origin who were raised on European ideas of nationalism and socialism, viewed, quote, Oriental Jews as backward and primitive from the moment they began arriving en masse on Israel's shores shortly after the founding of the state. He's not talking now about the Yishuv, the older population of Sephardim. He's talking about the Jews who came from Iraq, the Jews who came from Morocco, the Jews who came from Egypt, Yemen. Famed Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Ibn described in 1957 how Mizrahi Jews were, in the plainest sense, a direct threat to the nascent state of Israel. The goal must be to instill in them a Western spirit and not let them drag us into an unnatural Orient. One of the biggest fears is the danger that the large amount of immigrants of Mizrahi origin will force Israel to compare how cultured we are to our neighbors. That's the concern. And then the most horrific element of it, and we alluded to this when we talked about Menachem Begin. Right? Remember last year we talked about Begin and how he rode a wave of Sephardi support to the prime ministership in the 70s? So part of that was the story of the babies from Yemen. Right? How many of people here are familiar with the story of the Yemenite babies? Okay, so hold on to your hats. This is contested. Meaning that historians still debate to what extent this is true. But it's a very active and live issue. If you look at this article from Times of Israel staff, from October, as in this month, a couple of weeks ago, a lawsuit was filed in the case. Yemenite families of disappeared children file class action lawsuit. Dozens of families of Yemenite Jews who say their children were taken from them by Israeli authorities in the 1950s are filing a class action lawsuit demanding millions in reparations from the State of Israel and the Jewish Agency, Channel 10 reported Thursday. The lawsuit seeks to force the state to accept responsibility for at least 69 infants known to have disappeared from public institutions, such as hospitals and daycare centers. Some 49,000 Yemeni Jews were brought to the nascent state of Israel in Operation Magic Carpet in 1949-50. Since the 1950s, more than 1,000 families, mostly from Yemen, dozens from the Balkans, North Africa, other Middle Eastern countries, have alleged their children were kidnapped from Israeli hospitals and put up for adoption sometimes abroad in what is known as the Yemenite Children Affair. Disputed by scholars and seemingly refuted by three state commissions that examined the affair and concluded that most of the children had died, meaning that they had died in the institution and that they weren't kidnapped, the case has kept resurfacing, not least because most of the families were not given their children's bodies or informed of their burial places. The claims also come against the background of neglect and marginalization with which many Muslim world Jewish immigrants were greeted when they arrived in an Israel controlled at the time by an Ashkenazi Jewish elite. Families have also noted that many of the children's death certificates were riddled with errors. Most of the missing children were sent army draft notices to their original families 18 years after their alleged deaths. There have also been sporadic cases of adopted children who were able to confirm through DNA tests that they were from Yemenite families who were told they had died. The issue here is not even whether it actually happened, right? The issue is that the allegation itself matters. Meaning when you have a society in which people believe that the government has conspired against their ethnicity, then you have a recipe for disaster. But it's not only from the government that this is coming. It's not only from the labor movement and the kibbutz movement and the socialists. It's not only from them. There's a sense within the Sephardic community that the chief rabbinate is also against them. And even though you have a Sephardi chief rabbi and an Ashkenazi chief rabbi, there's still the sense that the Ashkenazim are dominant, because the chief rabbinate in the early state instituted policies which were geared toward unifying the observant Jewish community, but under the umbrella largely of Ashkenazi practice. So, for example, Jews who came in from Sephardic countries, many of the Sephardic countries, certainly North Africa, could practice polygamy. Whether you like polygamy or not isn't the point. It was part of their culture. It was part of their society. 1947, the chief rabbinate in Israel bans polygamy and says, Jewish law will not allow this in our country. Yibum. Right? The practice of Yibum. Go back to the Torah itself. If a man and a woman are married, and the man dies without having had children with her, so she has the option of marrying his brother, right, marrying her brother-in-law, or they can perform a ritual of chalitza, which separates them and ends that bond. But yibum is an option, right? Historically, this provided a way to take care of a widow, because in a society in which being able to remarry after this widowing would be difficult, she'd be part of the family, she was taken care of economically, and remember, it's polygamy. He could be married to somebody else and still take her into the family. He takes over the brother's lands. Sephardim still practiced it. Ashkenazim did not. They always said, do chalitza. They did not do yibum for a long time. In 1950, the chief rabbinate ruled that you're not allowed to do yibum, following Ashkenazi practice, even though, again, Sephardi communities were still doing it. There was an attempt, it didn't work, but there was an attempt to develop a single format of prayer, Nusach Achid, a unified form of prayer, and surprise, surprise, the dominant mode would have been, again, Ashkenazi. It's a melting pot scenario, and it's partly by force, and it's partly successful. And the result is that by the middle of the 20th century, the Ashkenazi community is economically dominant, and religion has been weakened among the Sephardim. Into this scene, enter Rav Ovadia Yosef. Now we'll start to understand, because of the preface, we'll start to understand some of the anger that you'll see within the Sephardi community and how it translates into support for his movement. But we have to go back now to 1920. Baghdad. Ovadia Yosef is born, actually, Ovadia Yosef Ovadia, meaning the family's last name was Ovadia. When he moved to Israel, he changed it to Ovadia Yosef, dropping Ovadia as his last name, because being called Ovadia, Ovadia is a little funny. But that's his last name is actually Ovadia. I understand that some of the family still retains that, but his last name was Yosef. Fine. He's born in Baghdad on the day after Yom Kippur in 1920. His family made Aliyah to Israel when he was 4 years old. When he was 9 years old, he wrote his first commentary to a work of Jewish law. He published a book, a commentary to a relatively esoteric tractate in the Talmud called Hariot, at the age of 17. He was sent to Yeshiva Parat Yosef at age 13. He starts to learn in the yeshiva. But his family, as I mentioned in the beginning, is a needy family. They're not well off. They have a store they run, and his father says, well, I need him in the store. No. Parat Yosef was Sephardi.
Recording. Okay. So, again, into this scenario, that's where we're up to. Rav Ovadia is in Parat Yosef at the age of 13. His father, though, pulls him and says, we need you to work in the store instead. He disappears from yeshiva for a couple of days. The Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, Rabbi Ezra Atiyah, a rabbi of quite a bit of standing in the community, says, where is he? And they tell him he's, home in the store. He goes to the store. He says, no, you have to send him to the yeshiva. And he says, well, I need him in the store. He takes off his jacket and he says, I will work in the store so that he can go to yeshiva. Which is not only an expression of Rabbi Tia's personality, although that is part of it. That's how he was known. But it's also his recognition that this was a unique talent. This is a kid who you needed to have develop with his scholarship. And at that point, his father relented and said, okay, if it means that much to you, he can go. In his teenage years, he would go at night to watch bookstores for their proprietors. and he would spend his time just reading through and memorizing the books on the shelves. He had a true photographic memory. When you read his responsa, it's very clear. Responsa normally, when you look at a work of Jewish law and a question is asked, an answer is given. So they'll quote some sources, they'll present some logical arguments, and come out with their position. That's not the way a Rabbi Ovadia responsum works. The way it works is this. Here's the question at hand. Here's the issue that it really can be digested to. Here are 130 or so sources on this side, chapter and verse. Here are maybe 76 or so on that side. The 130 are more than the 76, so the 130 win. That's more or less the way that his responsa work. And when I give you these numbers, I'm not exaggerating. His responsa go on for page after page after page after page, and it's all in his head. He's doing this before we had CD-ROMs with databases that you could search. He's doing this before you had Google to be able to look up this stuff online. It's all in his head. He took umbrage, though, when people said, well, he has a photographic memory, so of course he can do that. He insisted that he was able to learn these things because he learned them repeatedly. He may have learned more quickly than others, but he learned them repeatedly, and that was the way that it stuck, he insisted. Not to mention, it takes time just to photograph things. If you had a camera and you were going page by page and you were recording on a camera, you're talking about thousands and thousands of books that are all sitting there in his brain and accessible. That's just, I mean, there's nothing for it other than just to say, you just, I mean, I wanted to bring a responsum and just show it to you, just so you could see what it is.
He was a genius.
But it's not just the gift, it's the way he used it.
Yeah, but he was still gifted.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't feel bad that I can't do that. It's just, look, he's on a different planet. The man was on an absolute different planet. But he used it intensely. He didn't squander it. He spent all of his time with what's called in Hebrew hatmada in his community, or among Ashkenazim, hasmada. He learned constantly and throughout his life. Meaning that his grandson reported in a eulogy that when he would stay over at the house, and his grandfather was in his 90s, the grandson said, I would go to sleep at night, and it would be 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was still writing. And I would get up early in the morning at 6-something, and he was there writing. He was constantly working. His wife passed away in the 90s. So this was his life. His life was learning, leading, teaching, writing. That was what he did with all of his time. They reported how he would go to a family event. There was a brit for a great-grandson of his. And so he was the sandeg. He held the baby during the brit. And immediately after they did the naming, he went off to a side room and he learned. That was what he did. He would go to a wedding. There's a chuppah. Then there's downtime after the chuppah. So he'd pull out a book and he learned. That was the way he spent his time. When did he do all his politics? So they would come to his house at the for Shacharit in the morning. He prayed in his house, and he had a minyan there. Anybody could come. And this is part of his hallmark, that he was accessible to everybody. But the political leadership would show up there for Shacharit, and then he would take off his talit and tefillin at the end, and he would talk politics with them, and he would give them his insight and his guidance. He started teaching at the age of 17. He was sent to teach in a Jerusalem synagogue. More about that in a little bit. He was ordained at the age of 20. At the age of 25, he began serving as a judge on rabbinical courts in Jerusalem. In 1944, he married his wife, Margalit Fatal. The story that I've heard, but I have not been able to trace it to a source, the story that I've heard is that their first date is a disaster, as he spends all of his time discussing learning. But that he really wanted another date. And so they take a second date. The second date was a long walk, punctuated by three classes that he delivered in different places. So they walked, he gave a class, they walked again, he gave another class, they walked again. But she had a lot of patience, I guess. Margalit Fatal was her name. They had 11 children, and they have quite a few grandchildren. His children report that despite his really absurd schedule and all of his different involvements, he was very involved with them. He took pride in their achievements. He kept on it. On Shabbat, they said he was all father. The Shabbat was his day just to be with them, learning with them, and so on. The two hallmarks of Rav Avadya in general are scholarship and being a man of the people. The photographic memory is taken as a given. They actually had the best database for Jewish scholarship currently available in hard copy is a CD that's put out by Bar Ilan University. They're still working with a CD. Why, I don't know. They update it, but they still stick with a CD. But Bar Ilan University has it, and it's an incredible database. I mean, it's useful in so many different ways. It has tremendous sources from all eras of Jewish scholarship. So they tell the story, and supposedly the story was run by him, by one of the people I heard it from, that Rav Avadya actually was asked about it, and he confirmed that it was true, that they tested him, right, Man Against the Machine, right, John Brown and all of that. So they tested him against the machine to see which one would have more answers for a certain thing. They wanted to know, here is this thing, where is it discussed in all of responsa literature? And he came out with 23 sources, and the machine came out with 24. But then they checked and realized the 24th one was one of his writings that he had mentioned. They don't tell stories like that about other people. There are so many different stories about him. They brought manuscripts from Egypt from the 18th century, 19th century, that didn't have the names attached of who wrote them, and they didn't know what books they had come from, but they just had these manuscript scraps, and they showed them to him, 20 different scraps, and 17 out of the 20, he was able to identify who had written it, what book it was from, even though he hadn't read the books in 40 years. Those books he had read back when he had been in Cairo. This was decades later. That's in terms of his scholarship. But he's also man of the people in the sense that he loved people. His public lectures were not filled with, but included jokes, they included stories. At one point in his lectures, he serialized stories. So he'd tell you a few minutes of a story, and then say you have to come back next week for more of the story in order to get people to come back. He led the slichot. Sfaradim say slichot for a month before Rosh Hashanah, in the middle of the night. So he led the slichot minyan, and Sfaradim came no matter what their affiliation. It's described to me by people who were there. If people showed up there who had jeans and earrings and greased back hair and whatever else, and people showed up who had long black coats and big yarmulkes and long beards, it didn't matter. He was seen as being for everyone. And frankly, going back a little bit to the Yossi Sarid quotes, his populist rhetoric sometimes came back to bite him, because he would express himself in a way that he knew was going to appeal to people and he knew would draw crowds. And he would say things that were fiery, knowing full well that this was going to get taken out of context and it was going to anger people. So that's a little bit about him, first his early years and then a bit of his personality. In 1947, Rabbi Ben Zion Uziel, who would eventually become Sfaradi chief rabbi, asks Rav Ovadia to become chief rabbi of Egypt. Okay, this is 1947. Rabbi Ovadia is 27 years old. The community there was not a particularly strong community in terms of its observance. He ran afoul of the leadership there, because he insisted on trying to bring the community's Jewish institutions into what he considered to be strong Sephardi practice. So in one example of this, there was a Jewish-run hospital, and the Jews would tend to go there working with the assumption that the food they were getting was kosher food, because it was a Jewish hospital, and it was not. And he made a proclamation in the synagogue, not just any time, but Shabbat Zachor. Shabbat Zachor is the Shabbat before Purim. It is a Shabbat when the Torah reading about the war with Amalek is considered to be a biblical obligation, and therefore people make extra effort to be there. He knew he was going to have a packed house. And he made this announcement that the hospital that they're all going to, that they think is giving them kosher food, really is not. And obviously the leaders of the Jewish community were not terribly happy with him over this and other issues, and ultimately he left after just a few years there. He left in 1950, he went back to Israel, came and he became a dayan in Petah Tikva. He continued to publish primarily responsa. His responsa earned the Rav Kook Prize for Torah Literature in 1954 when he's just 34 years old. Won the Israel Prize in 1970. In 1965, he joins Israel's Supreme Rabbinical Court, the top Beit Din. In 1968, he becomes the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And he's quite happy there. Now, you know what Tel Aviv is. Tel Aviv is not a hotbed of religious practice in 1968. But he's very comfortable there. He's not looking to leave. When they draw him into campaigning for the chief rabbinate, which we're going to talk about in a minute, he doesn't want to go. He's very comfortable and happy there. He has a good-sized Sephardi population. He is among the people he wishes to serve, and he's very happy. But then you hit 1972. And here is going to be a callback to some of the things we discussed in our Celebrating 70 mini-series last year. Background. Rabbi Yitzhak Nissim, who we mentioned earlier, became Sephardi chief rabbi in 1954. At the time, you had 5-year terms. So Rabbi Nissim became Sephardi chief rabbi in 1954. Rabbi Isser Yehuda Unterman became Ashkenazi chief rabbi in 1964. There was a gap between Rabbi Herzog, who passed away, and then Rabbi Unterman becoming chief rabbi for the Ashkenazim in 1964. Rabbi Nissim, along the lines, has been winning re-election. So it's Rabbi Nissim on the Sephardi side, Rabbi Unterman on the Ashkenazi side. Their terms expired in 1969. Yeah. Good. Right. So I was going to mention that and then thought I would skip it, but I'm going to repeat it. Don't worry. I thought I would skip that, but now we're coming asked, so I'll mention it. The question was, when did they decide they were going to have two chief rabbis, Sephardi and Ashkenazi? It's actually a very big issue in Israel today. There's a lot of debate wanting to unify it. The original chief rabbi position under the Ottomans was the Chacham Bashi, and it was a decidedly Sephardi position. With the growth of the new Ashkenazi communities who came into Israel under the British mandate, they said, well, we want to have a chief rabbi of our own. And so they appointed Rav Kook to represent them, and he was recognized by the Jewish agency. But the Sephardim were not about to relinquish their position. And so you ended up with two positions, Ashkenazi and Sephardi, which you can see, based on what we discussed this morning, was necessary. In the sense that the Sephardim felt underrepresented, and as it was, they were unhappy. They felt they still were not being strongly represented, but at least they had their own chief rabbi. When you get to this era, they feel that they have a need for it. The Ashkenazim, for their part, are trying to solidify their authority and their power using the Ashkenazi chief rabbinate to do so.
So how who decided who would be the rabbi? How was they elected?
They had to work together. How were they elected?
Yes.
Okay, so the electorate in general, you should know, chief rabbis are not elected by the general population. There is a body that represents rabbis from different communities in Israel, the chief rabbinate council, which is a group of rabbis who are meant to advise the chief rabbis, and some politicians. Everybody gets together and they elect the two chief rabbis. Okay. So this actually becomes a very important point in the discussion now, because the two terms, the terms of Rabbi Nissim and Rabbi Unterman, expire in 1969. But in true Israeli fashion, the government does not arrange new elections until 1972. They just sort of continue. Don't worry about it, we're okay. And there is tremendous ugliness in the build-up to the 1972 elections because Rabbi Nissim and Rabbi Unterman did not get along. Rabbi Nissim ordered the Sephardi members of the Chief Rabbinate Council to boycott the meetings of the Chief Rabbinate Council because of the animosity. Rabbi Unterman says, what do I need with this? We're not getting anywhere. We don't have a quorum at our meetings. We can't do anything. And so he says, frankly, I've had enough. I'm not interested in running again in 1972. I did my years and I'm good. However, what happens at this moment is something we discussed at length last year, which is the Langer affair. Okay, for those who weren't here, or for those who don't recall the details, bless you, the story involves a claim that two children, now in their late teens, were mamzerim, they were illegitimate, that their mother had been married to a Jewish man, that they had separated without religious divorce, and that she had then remarried. There was a lot of debate because the question was he really Jewish in the first place? There was no record of a conversion. The problem was he said he was Jewish. And she said that he was Jewish. So it was this big fight of what's the status of the kids who were now serving in the IDF in the office of Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, who finds out that they are having trouble getting married and says, rabbis, you better deal with this or else we're just going to take marriage away from the religious groups altogether. We'll just say, well, make marriage civil marriage and be done with it. So you have this big fight that's going on in the lead up to 1972. Rabbi Unterman is of the opinion that they are, in fact, mamzerim, which was what most of the rabbinic community believed, that there was enough evidence to say that the father was Jewish, and therefore the children are now going to be unable to marry the people they want to marry. There are people they can marry, but not the ones they want to. The people they want to marry are not eligible to marry them. So Rabbi Shlomo Gorin makes it known that he has a lenient position. He believes, based on the evidence, that they are able to remarry. So he is pushed to run for Ashkenazi chief rabbi. Rabbi Unterman is not interested in campaigning for the position. It's going to go to Rabbi Gorin. Those who oppose Rabbi Gorin push Rabbi Unterman and say, you got to run. We can't afford to have Rabbi Gorin take office. Rabbi Unterman says, I'm going to run for office and then spend the next 5 years fighting with Rabbi Nisim. Forget it. I'm not interested. So the people who are pushing Rabbi Unterman to run say, no problem. We're going to push Rabbi Ovadia Yosef to run against Rabbi Nisim. So this way, it'll be Rabbi Ovadia Yosef on one side, Rabbi Unterman on the other side. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef says, I'm not interested. I'm really happy in Tel Aviv. What are you bothering me for? And then he decides to run. And in source number 8, I recognize that we have only 2 minutes left. But I robbed you of a minute when the recording stopped. So I'll just take an extra minute there. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, in true Rabbi Ovadia Yosef fashion, in source number 8, writes a responsum to explain his decision to run, because he views it as a halachic issue. The question is this: we have a principle in Judaism, you go up in holiness, you don't go down. So it's wrong to depose somebody who is a chief rabbi. Rabbi Nisim is the chief rabbi. I can't replace him. Even if elected, it will be wrong for me to take his place. On the other hand, he was elected with a 5-year term. So therefore, it's not like I am replacing him. You start fresh. Every 5 years, you start anew. And so he writes this long responsum, the most of which is bringing sources within Jewish history about the issue of replacing somebody in a religious position and whether you're allowed to do that, what if there is a fixed term, what if there isn't a fixed term, and that's how he debates it. But I didn't bring you the long middle. I brought you the beginning of it and a little bit from the end, in which he says, Rabbi Israeli Chief Rabbi Issa Yehuda Unterman was asked by rabbis of Israel to contend in the elections to be held against the other candidate, Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, so that he might remain in his sacred post. He acquiesced to their request on condition that I, a youth, put forth my candidacy for Israeli chief rabbi against Rabbi Yitzhak Nisim. He, Rabbi Unterman, claimed since Rabbi Nisim controls the Sephardi members of the chief rabbinic council, they boycott the meetings, the chief rabbinate is paralyzed, so he says he needs me to run. All the members of the Supreme Rabbinical Court, the High Beit Din, well-known scholars, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv, Rabbi Bezalel Zsolti, Rabbi Elezer Goldschmidt, and other sages have agreed, I have to run. He says, I don't want to. I'm doing well here in Tel Aviv Yafo. They love me. They treat me with affection and admiration. I have found favor in their eyes. I live among my nation in peace and tranquility, but they're pushing me to run, so maybe I really should. And he says, I'm not going to say anything about the conduct of Rabbi Nisim, as you see in the bottom line there. He says, I'm not interested in doing this. However, since I am being pushed, I'm going to go ahead. What's fascinating to me is, number one, he treats this as a halachic issue. He's going to discuss the legalisms of it. Number two, he's not afraid of putting all of this into a publicly published responsum. Rabbi Unterman has a problem with Rabbi Nisim. They can't get along. The chief rabbinic council is paralyzed. These are the sorts of things that usually are not discussed in public. Rabbi Ovadia doesn't do the whole filter thing. Everything is going to go into his published responsum, and everybody can read it for all time. Even the veiled statement of, I'm not going to say anything about Rabbi Nisim's conduct. There were some issues between Rabbi Ovadia Yosef and Rabbi Nisim, which we have to come back to next week in the discussion. Bottom line is, he agrees to run, and you end up with a mixed result. On the Ashkenazi side, Rabbi Gorin beats Rabbi Unterman. But on the Sephardi side, Rav Avadja beats Rav Nissim. So you end up with Rav Avadja Yosef and Rabbi Gorin, which is a little bit of a recipe for disaster. So we're going to talk about that, God willing, next week. There's just so much to say about Rav Avadja, and that we need to discuss. So hopefully we'll get through Rav Avadja next week and get to say something about Rav Mordechai Eliyahu before moving on to Rav Cook. Just one moment, please. The